Hey, health junkies. It's time for The Health Fix. Join your host, Dr. Janine Krause, as she gives you a dose of what you need to know and do right now to take control of your health from the inside out, to rebel against aging, look damn good, fight stress, and laugh every day.
Hello, health junkies. Welcome to another episode of The Health Fix. I have a fabulous individual here. He is a board certified doc. He is board certified in internal medicine and pulmonology, so pulmonary diseases. He also is a fabulous CMO, so Chief Medical Officer of MyMediClick.com. And that is what I'm really wanting to talk about today. And he brings all of his expertise from being a director of clinical trials at the Northern Westchester Hospital. So the big thing here for everybody that I want to bring across today about the podcast is that I'm wanting to be able to show you a way to link research that you can get ahead of time before you go into the doctor's office. So you're already prepared with questions so that you don't walk out going, oh, I didn't ask about this, or oh, I didn't know to ask about that. And so the big idea here is maximizing your efforts when you go to the doctor's office by using MyMediClick. And so without any further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Dr. Joshua Fink. Here he is.
Thank you so much. And I could not have asked for a better summary of what our mission statement really is about. You know, people spend less time with the doctors now than they ever did. And some recent research just came out which said that a great majority of the time, doctors are spending more time with their electronic medical records than they are actually seeing the patient. Mm-hmm. And I was recently seeing a doctor for myself, you know, the general physical, in which he never looked at me in the first 8 to 10 minutes of the exam. And he was taking my family history, and I was telling him about my family history. And he was, at which point he said to me, wow, you know a lot about medicine. You must watch all those TV shows. And I said to him, did you see what I do for a living? I mean, he never looked at me, and he never interacted with me. So, you know, how can a patient who doesn't know anything about medicine, how can they maximize their time with their doctor? And one of the best ways they can do that is by asking smart questions and getting the answers. And that's really important. You know, I find that the environment has changed now. You used to go to a doctor's office. They used to spend time with you. They used to ask you the questions. Now it's not about that. You go in, they have to see so many people a day. And after their exam is done, you sort of get pushed down the line to all the ancillary staff that comes in who may not have the expertise or knowledge basis or experience to answer your question about your condition. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we've learned from genetics and genomic medicine is there's no such thing as cancer. There's your cancer. And every condition is extremely different. The genetics are different. And so one size no longer fits all. So it's really important that we equalize that playing field, that we take the research, that we make it understandable to the everyday consumer, and that consumer can then shop for the smartest person that can answer their questions in a way that will be most meaningful for dealing with their condition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I find, I mean, yes, I do have spent a ton of time on the electronic health records, and I'm sure a lot of folks do. But the big thing then is yes, getting pushed down the line. You're rushing to your next visit and you're going, oh my gosh, I know I didn't answer those questions.
Right. That's exactly right. And so, you know, there's a real dichotomy which exists. You know, people that live in New York or live in California or in Texas, they can get some of the best hospitals, some of the best research, even in those places, unless the research is made understandable to the everyday consumer, they have no idea what they're looking at, right? They don't know how to put it in context. And then you take geographically more isolated areas, not just in the U.S., but throughout the world. For example, places in India, places in Brazil, places in Africa. What's their access to information? And what the listeners have to remember is that the next disease, the next epidemic we're going to deal with, it doesn't come from North Dakota. It's not coming from California. It tends to come from either Asia or Africa or other places where there's a vastly underserved population, where there's not good tools at tracking epidemiology. And that's what we're going to be dealing with more and more so in the future.
Wow. It's true. It's true. And so tell my audience here a little bit about how they can interact with your website, because I saw the different groups and it's
right.
like a forum. And I love that because you can also talk with people that are in the certain groups and make comments and in addition to get your own research and archive it.
Yeah. So that's cool. So my MediClick was designed to combine it was designed with three things in mind. Number one, we want to take information, make it understandable. And if you go to some of the other health information sites, you know, there's pages and pages and pages and pages of descriptions about your condition. And when you leave those pages, you really have no idea what you just read. Mm-hmm. So we want to take that information, make it easy, make it concise, and make it appropriate to our length of attention these days in society. Mm-hmm. The second thing was we added the social media component. So unlike Facebook, where you know, you go on and you either, you know, rant about your political views or you show pictures of your horse or your dog. We pretty much strict to help limit ourselves to health conditions and discussions about health conditions. So a person may have, for example, diabetes, and they may go on the site. They can join the diabetes group. They could read some of the latest information about diabetes, and they can directly ask questions about those articles to the administrators who are either physicians or nurses or clinical research coordinators who can then answer their question, even give them additional references that can further their appetite for knowledge. And then we have a whole different section in which we can offer personal research if you have a specific question that we can answer. Now, this site is completely free, but I will say that the personal research is a small fee. It's not enormous, but there is a small fee for that one. It helps keep the website running, basically. So that's how we are. I tell everybody we're 90% free. So you know, it's available, and our website is available in over 100 different languages. We have a translate bar on the top left corner, so you can access this. And like I said, in over 100 different languages now.
Wow, that is so neat. So friends could be like, well, you know, I've got this family member in Brazil, and like, I speak English and they speak Portuguese, and hey, we can translate it.
Well, we just had that for somebody in Greece, you know, where they didn't speak English, they only spoke Greek, and we were able to give them everything in their native language. And that's cool. And, you know, you get so, it's so hurtful to read some of the comments that we read about, you know, I have many diseases, but my number one disease is poverty. I mean, you know, it just hits us emotionally. That this is why we started, so that no matter what your income level is, no matter where you live, you deserve the same access to information that the wealthiest person can get and use it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So tell me a little bit about the personalized research, going into it a little bit further, because I did see, yeah, there's a $129, something like that. I don't remember exactly. I was that's time, you know, time equals money to me. And so thinking of all the different PubMed articles and all the different journals sifting through that. And I'm, you know, a doctor. I can imagine for folks who are, you know, a common person who's looking through all that crazy stuff. So what happens? You have someone assigned to you and they...
Well, basically what it does is it actually goes to an entire team. So that's pretty cool. So, you know, there's some forms that you have to fill out. We ask you very specific questions. In other words, you just can't say, tell me about diabetes. You know, it's just, you know, there wouldn't be enough days in the year for us to do that. But you may have a specific question. Let's say it's on prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. You may say, can you tell me more about Xtandi, which is one of the medicines to treat it? What can I expect with it? What are some of the limitations? Can you tell me more about the personal genomic research going on with prostate cancer? Or it might be about breast cancer. A personal research question that was recently asked to us was, what's the difference between Femara and some of the other drugs which are being offered to me? I have HER2 negative, you know, estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? So we will get very specific with the personal research that we offer with people, so that we're not in any way, shape, or form trying to be their doctor.
Sure.
What we are trying to give them is information, so that when they go to their doctor, the nurse practitioner, whoever they are seeing, their care coordinator, their nurse navigator, whoever they are seeing to coordinate their care, they can then go with vetted information that they can ask them that will specifically apply to their condition.
Absolutely. Oh, that's cool. And I also saw that you have a link there for, I'm gathering, linking folks up with clinical trials. So
right.
I saw that in there.
Yeah, so the clinical trial environment is extremely complicated for people to navigate. You go on a couple of different sites, and you have no idea what they're even talking about. So what we'll do is we'll say, you know, tell us about your disease. We need to see the pathology report. We need to see what's there. And then we'll use our knowledge and experience to try to see if we can match you with any of the trials that are presently out there, at least give you contact numbers that you can reach. People that you can see and make calls to them, you know.
Wow.
So it's really important because I think the American Society of Clinical Oncology said that over and over again that every single cancer patient should be in a clinical trial because it's been shown repeatedly by multiple sources that patients who have cancer who are in clinical trials tend to do better. Why? Because there are more people looking at their case. That's important. And also, they may be getting new therapies, not yet FDA approved, but may show some benefit, or they may not. And that's why it's a trial.
Sure, sure. And I think for a lot of people, they'll be told at a particular facility, no, there's nothing that you qualify here.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly. And I'll tell you, I think there's bias in the community, in the medical community, because, you know, for an oncologist, you know, to give up the patient and go somewhere else to get a trial done. There are financial incentives for physicians to keep patients in their practice. And it's our personal desire that those people get the best available care no matter where they have to go.
Absolutely.
So, the whole system does need to change. And we can't change the system, but we can change our piece of it. And that's important to us.
Absolutely. I love that. I love that. So all that being said, I want my folks to get a sense of what kind of research background you have, because you are a wealth of knowledge. My goodness, the other day when I talked to you, I was like, I could talk to this guy for weeks. I would geek out for weeks.
Thank you.
So
this week, I'm obsessed with it.
Oh, man. I love it. I love it. And you were talking a ton about the genetics and talking even just now a little bit about the connection with cancer and genetics and whatnot. And I wanted you to kind of show my folks the depth of your knowledge and probably the depth of all of your staff that would be working with them with my MediClick.
Sure. Well, you know, our knowledge of genomics has, I'd like to say it's the tip of the iceberg, but it's certainly within the past couple of years, we've seen how our knowledge about genomics and immunotherapy is starting to actually make a difference in treatments which are going on. Everybody's seen ads on TV for medicines like Optivo or Keytruda, this whole immunotherapy which is going on. We understand now that every single cancer is different. Let's take, for example, breast cancer. Okay, so the good news is more women are living now than ever before who've had breast cancer. We've made serious, serious inroads into lifespan with breast cancer. Compared to 10, 15 years ago, it's a whole different playing field these days, which is great. So, it all started with, you know, looking for estrogen and looking for progesterone and looking for those receptors on the cells. And, you know, the problem was that, you know, you look at under a microscope and breast cancer is breast cancer. And there are certain characteristics which make you think that it's more or less aggressive. The lymph node status is important and all that's important. But what we've really discovered now is that the genomics of that cancer may be different for every single woman that has it. And there are gene panels which can routinely be done now on pathology samples to tell a woman what is her risk of recurrence. Okay, so there are many women that have this condition called DCIS, for ductal carcinoma in situ, which is basically considered like a precancer in many ways. And so, you know, they have an abnormal mammogram, they have a biopsy done, they get a diagnosis of ductal carcinoma in situ, And then, you know, comes the anxiety and the fear with that type of diagnosis, you know, with the patient saying, am I going to get breast cancer? What's my risk? Should I be taking tamoxifen for 5 years? Should I be on an aromatase inhibitor drug, like, you know, like letrozole? You know, what are my options out there? Mm-hmm. Well, now there's a gene panel that doctors can routinely do to look to see how many of these genes in breast cancer are being expressed. And we can then stratify to say you're a low risk for recurrence, a moderate risk, or a higher risk for recurrence. And that's one example of how genomics is changing how we do things. Here's another great example. You know, there are many men that have elevated PSAs. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, prostate cancer is occurring in younger and younger ages. My personal suspicion is all the endocrine disruptors in the environment, I think, have something to do with that. All the BPAs, which we were told were not a problem, and which people still say is not a problem, but in my own personal opinion, I disagree. You know, if you look at prostate cancer, there are sets of genes which are present on that biopsy, which can tell you, outside of the Gleason score, how genetically aggressive that cancer is going to be. And so you may have somebody that has a Gleason score of maybe 5, which is not sort of in the midway of, you know, very aggressive is 10. So let's say they're sort of that midway and they're debating, well, should I just do this active surveillance? You know, should I just watch and wait, and just, you know, get my biopsies every 6 months and see that this changes? Or should I do this genetic profile out of it? And it'll tell me, it may look like a 5 under the microscope, but what are the genes telling me? And you may get back this Prolaris score, which is the name of the test, which shows that this is more of an aggressive tumor. And that may make you decide, maybe active surveillance is not really the thing I want to do. I want to do some type of treatment, be it surgery or alpha beam therapy or radiation therapy. Maybe I want to do something except nothing. Mm-hmm. So this is how the genetics are sort of coming into play. And one more great example, you know, colon cancer, for example. You know, we've started to learn a lot about colon cancer, more so than ever before. The risk factors for it, what you can do to modify your risk factors for it, the genetics of colon cancer, you know, the families that have to be concerned. A lot of people aren't aware that if there's a history of uterine cancer in the family, mm-hmm. it may increase the risk of colon cancer in the family, something called Lynch syndrome. Yes. There are genetic tests that can be done to determine if you're one of those patients that may have that mutation in those genes, which means you should have a colonoscopy at an earlier stage. Mm-hmm. But how would a patient even know about that unless their doctor gets a chance to talk to them about it? Right. Mm-hmm. They don't. They just wouldn't.
I ended up getting tested for it because my family has a history of both, and I had no idea even about it. And so that's the only way.
How did you find out about Lynch syndrome, for example?
From the genetic counselor at the University of Washington that I went to, because I had no idea. I wasn't taught it. It wasn't even on my radar.
I think it's getting to the point now in the future where there really can no longer be a dichotomy between a physician and a genetic counselor. Mm-hmm. I think that they need to be part of that comprehensive team that sees every patient. That's my own personal belief where it's going to go.
Oh, I absolutely agree. In fact, I was going to ask your opinion. Now, they have these tests that folks, I don't like that it's touting to take this genetic test instead of getting a colonoscopy. I'm kind of going, I don't like that.
I agree.
What is your thought on the accuracy of some of those kits out there? I think they call it, I want to say Cologuard, but that doesn't sound right because I think that's just...
Well, Cologuard is Cologuard looks at certain genetic mutations that you can get in the stool to see mm-hmm. if those mutations are present. You know, Cologuard really is not replaced, nor should it replace screening colonoscopies. It has a role. It's like stool guaiac tests did where they would check for blood. It has a role. But, you know, nobody is touting it as a replacement, nor should it be. Right. If you look at, you know, one of the questions that, you know, I had recently seen and had discussed the case of somebody that had colon cancer, young, she was in her mid-40s, incredible condition. I mean, aerobics instructor, probably 10%, 9% body fat during Christmas. So, you know, really in great shape, non-smoker, enjoys her occasional glass of wine. Like I said, exercises and no family history.
Sure.
So, wow. So how do you explain cases like that? You know, interestingly enough, there was recently a study which looked at the role of the microbiome on colon cancer risk. And, you know, the microbiome, just in case your audience doesn't know what it means, is a generic term for all the bacteria that live in your body. And we call that the microbiome. So basically, if you look at your cells, okay, you're only 10% of who you are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you take 10 cells in your body, 9 of those are going to be bacteria and 1 is going to be you. So it was very interesting because when I was recently teaching at a college last year, I think I might have freaked some of the students out where I said everybody here is just a transport system for a bunch of bacteria. But, you know, I mean, it's somewhat of a pictorial description, but it is somewhat accurate. So, you know, the microbiome is something that affects so many aspects of our health. It's been linked to glucose control for diabetes. It's been linked to colon cancer. It's been linked to autism. It has been linked to cognition and memory. It's been linked to autoimmune diseases like ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease. And I suspect that the list is going to go on from there. And there was recently, you know, we know all this old information that high-fat diets increase the risk of colon cancer, you know, the Western diets. Sure. You know, and I always sort of sat back when everybody was saying, well, I'm going to be on a high-fat, low-carb diet. And I'm like, is that such a good thing to do? Yeah. You know, my mom once told me moderation is the key to everything. And I think without being a doctor or a geneticist, just being a good social worker, I think she was right. Moderation is the key. But, you know, we really want to know how do high-fat diets really increase the risk of colon cancer. And it seems that it might be via one of the bacteria that's present in the colon that takes the fat that you're consuming and changes it into some compounds that are really not too good for you. And that is probably why there's a difference in the fact that some people can eat a high-fat diet and get no problems, and others might, and they get a cancer. And, you know, we're really not understanding the microbiome yet. We are a drop of water in an ocean of information right now. That's our level. There's a company in Boston who has the most boring job in the world, but probably one of the most crucial jobs going on right now, is they are characterizing the bacteria in the colons of normal people and the colons of people with various diseases. And they're doing genetic profiles on them. And they are asking a really important question: which bacteria predominant in which conditions, and what are the genetic profiles of those bacteria? Because I envision a day where the doctor of the future is going to give you a prescription that has a specific colony of bacteria for your specific condition to see if we could somehow bring back into balance what it should be. So it's really cool what's going on right now. And some of our information, you know, is really, we think it sounds really good. It sounds, wow, this is exciting. This is really sexy information. But then we find out down the road that it really wasn't so true. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about C-sections, right? And about babies that are born on C-sections do not get exposed to the microbiome that they would if they underwent the normal birthing process.
Right.
And then it was shown that those babies undergoing C-sections had higher risks of eczema, have higher risks of autoimmune diseases, have higher risks of cognitive, or should I say, not cognitive dysfunction, but that's the wrong word. They tend to have lower test scores, you know, on testing. And there were all types of, and, you know, higher risk of juvenile diabetes. I mean, there were all types of things coming out in the literature. So a great study was just done in which they basically took a swab from mom, and they exposed it to the C-section baby, so they covered the baby's mouth and face with, you know, with the normal flora that the baby would ordinarily be exposed to while going through the birthing canal. And the bottom line was, I don't really think it showed much of a difference.
Hmm.
So, you know, it may be that the microbiome during development, during the time that the baby is in utero, that mom's microbiome is the time that's the crucial time to exposing a developing child, versus that 12 or 14 or, Lord help you, the 24 hours that might be associated with the birthing process. So, you know, we have information, but sometimes we're too quick to jump on conclusions. And that's why it's really important to keep gathering information, keep asking smart questions. Unfortunately, when you go to a doctor's office, you know, you ask them about a probiotic, the typical response is, sure, take something.
Right. Get the yogurt in, you know, why not? Right.
Yeah. And equally as bad is somebody that says, well, I have a probiotic here, and this is going to, I mean, you don't know what that probiotic is going to do. There are billions of bacteria in the colon. There are hundreds of millions of different species of those bacteria. And even taking one bacteria out of balance can make you sick. I'll give you a great example. We were discussing gastroesophageal reflux disease last week, and somebody had read who was at risk for esophageal cancer that strep galactia was higher in the patients who did not get esophageal cancer. And so this particular person's looked for a probiotic online that contained this particular species of streptococcus. And wouldn't you know, it made his esophageal reflux worse. Mm-hmm. So there's a world of information. And one of the things I really want to draw that's important for everybody to understand is your bacteria in your body are, I don't want to put this in a way that's understandable, are very skittish about newcomers coming in. They don't like changes in their neighborhood too quickly. Mm-hmm. All right? So if you start introducing sudden changes in the bacterial environment in the intestines, don't be surprised if you feel sicker first, because they don't like too many changes. So the changes that we talk about should be slow, should be done over time. As important as probiotics are prebiotics, the things which feed the bacteria that you normally have. Great example, the Germans knew that with sauerkraut. The Koreans know it with kimchi. We probably know it with kefir or other products like that. They all sound good to me. But the probiotics are certainly part of maintaining a healthy balance.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I like that you say to go slow, because that's one thing that a lot of my patients want to jump to the 90 billion pills. And I said, you're not going to do so well on that.
That's exactly right. And, you know, one of the other things that the bacterial colonies have been associated with is acne. Mm. I mean, you know, I've had this long expression of medicine for a long time. You show me a kid with bad acne, and I'll show you a kid that doesn't eat fish. And so, you know, we know omega-3s have a role. We know vegetables have a role. You know, we know that probiotics have a role. These all have a role. You know, the skin is the largest organ in the body, and if the body's out of balance, the skin will reflect it. Just ask any smoker, all right? Their skin looks different than non-smokers. You can always tell a smoker's skin. If you've been doing this like I've been doing for a while, you can always tell when they walk in. You can always say, this is a pack-a-day smoker, just looking at the skin. So it's very hard, you know, to get people to eat those 5 servings of fresh fruits and vegetables a day. You know, when I was teaching college, you know, these are really smart, you know, students. I mean, they all know what they know, right? But I would look at them and I would ask the very basic question, so what's a serving? Look at me. No idea. The smartest answer I got to that was 3/4 of what I had already just eaten. I said, I guess that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. But what's a serving? So, you know, the definition of the serving is different depending on who makes the definition. So I wish some governing body like the U.S. Food and Drug Administration or the American Diabetes Association or somebody will come out and say, dum ba dum bum, this is officially a serving, okay? Because I've heard things from all over. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's totally crazy. And speaking of the American Diabetes Association, you know, a lot of times I look at their guidelines and I keep struggling with folks with not getting their blood sugars in balance. And oftentimes I go back to the microbiome. And if I can get folks eating a little bit of the prebiotics, which if we notice, almost every prebiotic has a carbohydrate in it.
That's exactly right. Because you got to feed those bacteria. That's exactly right. You know, there was an interesting study that just came out of the University of Southern California. They have a Center for Longevity Research. Mm-hmm. And they looked at what's called a fasting medical diet. Now, there have been a lot of people talking about fasting. And fasting, if done incorrectly, could be extremely dangerous, especially if you're on medicines that are lowering blood sugar in the first place. So I would tell anybody, do not do a fasting diet unless you're under some type of strict observation by a knowledgeable medical professional. So I got to make that disclaimer right now. Mm-hmm. But they looked at fasting medical diets, which were done in a series of 5-day diets. And they did 3 cycles in them, I believe, over 3 months. And they looked at waistline. They looked at blood pressure. They looked at cholesterol. They looked at C-reactive protein, which is a protein that that's a marker of inflammation of the body. They also looked at something else, which was called IGF-1. So insulin growth factor 1 is basically the hormone that growth hormone works via. And IGF-1 levels tend to, they do a couple of things, but one of the things that they do that's bad for you is they may increase your risk of numerous types of cancers. And this group out of USC, they looked at this FMD, this fasting medical diet, and it was strictly supervised, and it was ages 20 to 70, and it was anywhere from 750 to 1,100 or 1,200 calories a day. And they said, what happens to all these parameters? And what they found was blood pressure went down. They lost 1 to 2 inches of body fat, but not muscle mass, which was really interesting. Hmm. Glucose levels went down. Fasting glucose level went down. C-reactive protein went down, and most importantly, IGF-1 levels went down to what was considered to be the non-cancerous range. So this was fascinating. But then they took it one step further, and they said, okay, we did the 5-day fast, now get off of it. And what they found was those parameters were maintained.
Wow.
Those lower levels were maintained when they went back to normal eating, as if the clock got reset. And then they asked a really important question. They said, okay, we did the 3 months. What happens 3 months from now? And guess what? The parameters are still maintained. They reset the clock. Now, is it because they reset the microbiome? Or did they reset the hormones? Or was it all of it? Possibly all. We don't know. But, you know, most of the diseases that occur as we get older, I hate to admit it, are diseases of aging. Mm-hmm. Okay? Arthritis. You know, Alzheimer's disease, glaucoma, various cancers, obviously are higher risk as we get older than when we're younger. So if we could do something naturally that can help us reset the clock, now this was a small study. I think it had only 70 plus people in it, maybe around 70, 71. So of course, as they say, larger studies are going to be needed. But it's not the first study that's ever said that there's a role for this intermittent fasting in terms of maximizing health. So important to emphasize again, not to be done unless you're being closely supervised by a medical professional who can watch out and adjust things if they need to be, because hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, can kill you. Mm-hmm. So really important that this is done under proper supervision.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Gosh, Dr. Josh, this has been amazing. I am definitely going to have to chat with you more. I know my audience is going to want to hear more. I wanted to get into hormone disruptors today, but unfortunately I have to go see patients.
Yeah. Thank you for doing that. Oh, can I just put in one quick thing?
Yes.
Please go to my MediClick, write your comments on the articles. We learn when we all talk to each other. Some of the greatest breakthroughs in medicine have come from patients saying, hey, I just took this drug, And I noticed this little side effect, by the way. That's how Botox was discovered. They were doing it for spasms of the eye, and the side effect was it decreased the wrinkles. So we don't know what comes about when we start talking to each other. Come to the website. It's free. Talk. We interact. We'd love to hear you there.
Absolutely. Sharing information. We need to share, everyone, please. That's what my podcast is all about, and that's what I'm going to continue to do, and Dr. Joshua as well. And yeah, go check out mymediclick.com. I think it's a valuable resource. I can't wait to start getting all my patients on it.
On behalf of my team, I'd like to say thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for tuning in to The Health Fix, the podcast all about taking control of your health, rebelling against aging, and having fun every day. A lot of patients ask me, do you think I'm aging too fast? So, I created an evaluation checklist for you to see for yourself. Plus, I created a resource guide to help you slow down the aging process right now. You can find it for free on my website, drjkrausnd.com. If you like this podcast, help get the word out to others by liking it and rating it. If you'd like more natural health tips and want to join our Facebook community where I interact daily, click on the Join Group button on our website at drjkrausnd.com.